Well, good afternoon. Lovely morning tea and wonderful meeting this morning. I'm Diane. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic. Lovely to be here and thanks for the opportunity to be of some service. And it's always a little nerve-wracking when someone tells you you've got an hour. So what my plan is to talk for probably three quarters of an hour, or close enough to, and then throw it over to you for questions and answers or anything you'd like to share. So I hope that's okay with you. I'm going to try and keep an eye on my time, which is right here, but Brooke is very kindly going to give me the 5-minute heads up when we're at about 40 minutes, 20, yeah, when we're 40 minutes in. So my name is Diane. I am an adult child and alcoholic, and I'm also someone who's been in recovery for a very long time. I've been, just so you know, I've been 47 years clean and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And yes, I got in very young. And one of the reasons I got in very young, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my history, and then I want to talk about recovery and how that dovetails into the steps I've needed to take, and also bring in a bit of conversation about trauma, because I actually think that's what we're dealing with in this fellowship in a way that it's not dealt with in any other fellowship. And the people that shared their experience, strength and hope this morning were very clear about the fact that many of them had recovery and then didn't really feel like they had what they needed, were feeling disconnected from themselves and then found themselves in ACA, and there their recovery has blossomed. And I think that's the consistent message we get. So I was raised in an alcoholic family with a chronic alcoholic mother and a father who drank as much as she did but was not an alcoholic. He was a chronic gambler. So he was absent and in his own way, and she was in the bedroom, locked in the bedroom. And as a child, I was allowed to go to the door, and it was in darkness, so I wasn't allowed to go in, but I could stand at the door and I could ask for something. The answer was often silence or no, and I didn't know what else to do. I felt responsible for her. I grew up feeling like if I was a better daughter, child, from a very young age, thinking part of her drinking was my fault. And part of the trick for her and for me was that she was a bender drinker. So she'd stop for 3 months. Absolutely no drinking. There'd be some semblance of normalcy in the home. And I'd think, oh, it's going to be okay. There'd be food on the table. That'd be interesting, a novel thing. And then she'd go on another bender for 3 to 6 months and I wouldn't see her again. And he would dip in and out. And so there was no parental control in my life, and I'm finding that really distracting, that picture of myself. So I'm going to kind of turn away. Because you know me, I just want to watch how good looking I am. Just make sure the hair's looking okay, right? The pearls are in place. So, anyway, there was no parental control and no limits in my life. So I learned to be needless and wantless. There's no point in asking for anything because nothing was going to come my way. And at the age of 10, I was on the streets. And I would sort of come in and out. In the same way that I observed her come in and out of life, I did a bit the same. So, you know, I was pretty traumatised. I didn't know that. I was very out of control as a child. I went from being a shy, terrified child, and around about the age of 10, I found drugs and I used them. And by the time I was 14, I had a heroin addiction and I drank a lot. And the one person I didn't want to be like was my mother, of course. I was never going to be like her. And, of course, guess who I ended up being exactly like and then some? It's like not only was I doing what she did, but I did worse. You know, my life became full of crime and gravitated to people like I was. And so I didn't stand out as being anything different. Anyway, long story short, you can fill in the gaps. The two things very quickly I can tell you about myself. As a practicing alcoholic and addict, the two things I could say to you about myself before I got into recovery was that I'd never been pregnant and I had never been to jail. I can no longer say those two either. I did both of those in recovery. So by the time I was taken to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting 48 years ago, I was 17 years old and I was on the streets and I was very high maintenance. And I didn't want what the people had. I thought it was great for all of them. But after 8 months of kicking around the rooms and then having my last relapse, I came back with the tail between my legs at 18 years of age and I started to get well. And I very simply did that for the same reasons I imagine that you come to ACA. And that is, I found within those rooms people who actually didn't judge me and understood where I'd been. They'd been to where I had been and they had recovered. And that appealed to me. So I went and I stayed. NA hadn't started in Sydney at the time. ACA was a distant dream in someone's mind, probably in America somewhere. There was Al-Anon and that was it. There was no such thing as SLA, little bit of GA, that's about it. So it was the wild frontier in many ways, you know. People were drunk in meetings, you know, they'd air raid, you know. We've kind of tidied up our act now, haven't we? Look at us. We look all very tickety-boo in our gear, you know. We're not messy at all when we get here. Anyway, so it goes. So my recovery started. And, of course, you know, I did what I was asked, I thought, in the rooms of AA through the 12-step program, exactly the same program. Now, it would have been fair for me to say to you that I had had a family, if I could, well, I don't know that I would have ever referred to them as that, but the two people that had supposedly been my caretakers had done a pretty poor job of it. They had no skills at all. And I hesitate to tell this story, but it's in my head, so I'm going to ask you to bear with me while I tell this story. This one story encapsulates how it was for me as a child, and then I want to move on to recovery. And I tell this story because it was a repressed memory that didn't come to me until about 20 years ago. And my mother had been on a bad bender. She had been drinking the rent money. I was looked after by people, you know, that were a half an hour walk from where I lived in the evening, and my father would come at 10 o'clock and I was a seven-year-old child and pick me up, and we would have to walk the half an hour home because God knows they didn't have enough money to have a car because she was drinking it and he was gambling it. And on the walk home, my father said to me, now this was, it was particularly because my father didn't connect with me in any way really. And he said to me this night in the dark as we walked home, I want you to pack up the house on the weekend because we have to move. Your mother's been drinking the rent money. Okay. I'm seven. I don't even know what that means, really. I've grown up far too quickly already. I'm looking at all of you thinking you probably have had a similar experience to that. If you're raised with dysfunction and alcoholism, you grow up really fast, or you disappear, or you do both. And so I had to pack up the house as it was. It was in the days when people rented homes that were furnished, so I had to pack up all the other stuff that wasn't big. And the milkman, who was a swarthy Italian man, was going to come with his tabletop truck and I was going to help him put the boxes into the back of the truck. And I was then going to try and move my mother, whom I hadn't seen for 2 months because she was in the room in the darkness, and he had to help me carry her down the stairs and into the front of the car and drive to this new flat we were living in. It's what every seven-year-old does, isn't it? Like, I don't know any different. And God knows, I got no one to tell about what's happening. And this isn't the worst of it. I went to my mother the day before, when I'd finished the packing on the Saturday, I went to the darkened room and I said to my mother, a stray dog... Now, we don't have strays these days, but in those days, strays would turn up in the backyard and you would sort of adopt them, right? And we didn't have grooming for my dog gets groomed every 3 weeks, looks very handsome. This dog never got groomed. I don't ever think he had a bath. Rusty, I called him. and he was about as wild as I was. And I loved this dog with a passion because he was my friend. I didn't have many friends at school. I didn't connect with other kids. I didn't have sleepovers. No one was coming to my house in the afternoon, that's for sure. And I said to her, what are we going to do about Rusty? She said, ring the RSPCA. So somehow or another, I managed on the black telephone, many of whom are too young to remember these, you had to pick up a lever like this and then you had to dial a number and you had to wait for somebody to answer. And I said to the lady on the end of the phone, I've got a dog and, you know, can you come and pick him up and we have to move. And this woman, I can still hear her voice. Do you know those experiences you have? Still hear her voice. And I knew that she knew that I was in a dire situation and I had nobody that was helping me. And I said to her, what happens when... She said, we'll go and pick him up the pound and when we... And I said, what will happen? She said, we'll find someone to look after him. And I went, okay. And what happens? She said, we keep him for a week. If your mother can pay $5, which is a lot of money back then, we can keep the dog for a week and then someone will adopt him. And I said to my mother through the door, can I have $5 so that they can keep Rusty for a week now? She said, I haven't got $5. I went back and spoke to the woman on the phone. I said, we don't have $5. And the woman was silent and I said, what will happen to Rusty? And she couldn't answer me. And at 7 years of age, I knew. Now, I can still feel that in the back of my throat today. And I'm a 65-year-old woman that's done 47 years of recovery. And let me tell you, I have not missed a day of my recovery. So I moved the few boxes we had and my mother into the new flat. And I walked back to the house and the pound guy turned up. And, of course, Rusty was going to bark at him really badly because he didn't like anyone going near me. So the man, another adult, got into the cabin of the car and wound his window down this far, 2 inches maybe, and said, can you put the dog in the back? So I, as a seven-year-old, have to pick up the one thing I love more than anything else and put it into the back of the car, the truck, you know, with the and lock it and give him the keys and he drives away. Now, I don't remember that until well over 30 years in recovery. And that's what trauma did to me. And that's one story. There's a whole other lot, which I won't bore you with. So I don't want to upset anyone today. And as Lawrence very kindly reminded me, you can't trigger anyone. That's up to them, die. Okay, tell the story when okay. But I say that just because I want you to understand that I hadn't even picked up a drink or a drug at that point. And the two people in my life that were supposed to look after me had no clue about what to do. And, you know, we often say in recovery, well, you know, if they could have done better, they would have done better. Well, maybe that's true, but sure as hell they didn't know better. So 3 short years later, I start using my drinking and drugging. By the time I'm 17, I'm in AA. At 18, I get sober. And I start to do all of the things that people in 12-step programs talk about. I'm agnostic, borderline atheist. I don't know how you feel about your higher power, but mine was as sick as I was when I walked into the rooms. And I had to listen to other people share their experience, strength and hope about how they connected with something spiritually, how they connected with someone else, something outside themselves, something bigger or something big within themselves, whatever it is. And it was a slow progress. And what I would say to you about my relationship with a higher power is that it's very different today as it was when I first started, because initially when I came to the group, I could stay sober and had a chance of turning my life around because I sat with you. Collectively, you were a bigger power than me. So my group became my higher power. And then, of course, it changed. I went down various spiritual routes as I've tried all of the different machinations that are available to us. I took what I liked from some, I left some of it, and now I sit in a space where I'm very comfortable with all of it and have no argument with anything, and whatever you believe is absolutely fine with me. And I understand that because of I'm a spiritual person having a human experience, I'm probably going to change my view about my spiritual life. And that's all right too. So the thing I didn't know about trauma when I got clean and sober and I was, you know, trying to have relationships with people and I married in my first few years of recovery and at about 10 years clean decided that probably wasn't the wisest move I'd made in my life and stepped out of that relationship and he's still in recovery and a very decent bloke and just was not for me. And then I thought, well, I'm just going to then, you know, my career's kicked off because, you know, I've done some work on this stuff. I don't want to be dangling at the bottom of the food chain, thank you very much. I'm watching people. I'm watching you. I'm watching what you do with your lives and how you try things and how suddenly you get brave about stuff. And I'm a bit unsure about that, but I follow suit. I do my best. And so I have, you know, a career and that kind of kicks off and, you know, we often talk in 12-step, I'm terrified of failure. I'm terrified of failure. You'll hear people say, well, that may be. But have a go at something and get some success and see how terrified you feel then. Because I can tell you, when I started to get success in my life, I knew a fear that I'd never known before. Because there was no argument. There was no way I could point to the thing that wasn't happening in my life and blame that for why I was the way I was. Some years ago, I suppose I was about 30 years sober and my marriage to a man whom I thought I'd spend the rest of my life with went south in a major way. He relapsed. He's all right today. You know, he's doing well, but I'm a child of alcoholics. I can't live with someone who's in relapse. I'm sorry, I make no apology for that. It's just how I roll. And it catapulted me. I was on my knees about it, but it catapulted me into Al-Anon. Now, I'm not sure of the timing, but it was around about that time, shortly after, and I threw myself into Al-Anon in an attempt to understand why, after all of these years of recovery and therapy, I actually found myself in a very similar situation, in a relationship with someone who was in addiction. And ACA started in Sydney. And I was amazed. I got hold of the red book and I remember talking to Libby and Pat. This was very new ground for us, or for me. And I read that book and I was flipping through it last night knowing I was going to talk today and I thought, if that book is not divinely inspired, I don't know what is. And I know Alcoholics, I know our big book in Alcoholics Anonymous and I know the NA big books, you know, all of that. I know that. But I read it and it's like it's the new version, it's like the up-to-date version. If AA was in its incarnation right now, I think a lot of the stuff that was in that, the big red book, would be in it. You know, they talk about boundaries, they talk about sponsorship, they talk about, you know, well, the laundry list and the opposite side of it. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And one of the things that I know that happened to me was that I started to delve into this and I started to do some more therapy. Now, one of the things that happens to me when I'm traumatised, and I just want to just segue a bit into that if you don't mind, is two things will happen, you know. Prefrontal cortex, biggest part of my brain, the brain that's actually, you know, get up, get dressed, have breakfast, get on with your day, right? If I'm in a situation where I'm traumatised, as I was as a child, I would not walk into that place that we lived without sort of sniffing the air to see if I was welcome. It's like I could tell before I walked in what was going on in that house. And I brought all of that into the room. So I would walk into a meeting and it's like I'd be scanning you guys, sniffing in the air to see if I was welcome. I didn't look like I was doing that. That's exactly what I was doing. Because I lived in fight or flight. And for years we talked about fight or flight or freeze. And now we also talk about fawn, which is, of course, the people-pleasing and the codependency. So I would sit in fight or flight a lot. And I had a conversation earlier with a member here today about how and it's been talked about this morning, about disassociation, you know, how I'll leave myself. So I can be fight or flight. I can disappear, freeze. And when I'm in a traumatised child, that's exactly what I'm going to do in my relationships. And I'm going to particularly do it if I'm trying to have an intimate relationship with someone, whether it's a friend or whether it's a potential partner. So, you know, we often throw around the comment, you know, if you want to wake up in your life, well, get into a relationship and see what happens. You know, if you want to see where your issues are, try a relationship. Right? Now, there are those of us, and I put myself in this category, that have done that. Some of it's turned out all right, some of it hasn't. So we're kind of in that. I'm trying my best. You know, I'm having tentative steps at a relationship. But if I get too frightened in that relationship, I will freeze over here. I will go back to sleep and I will disappear. I'm still in the relationship with you. I'm still standing in front of you. But, man, I'm over there somewhere. And you who are having a relationship with me will know that I have gone. And you will think it's about you. If I've chosen wisely and I've chosen someone who's as, dare I say, unwell as me, they will blame themselves. And so we'll get into this dance. And that's my experience as you get along in recovery. As I've gotten along in recovery, that's where it's shown up in my relationships. When I was 15 years clean and sober, I had married for the second time. And I was a woman who had said to myself, I will never have children. And I understand now that the reason I said that was because I didn't want to do to my child what my mother did to me. And I needed to go and do some more serious work on my relationship with my mother and my father, or my mother at that point, so that I could get to some point where I would sit with it calmly. Now, of course, as soon as you say to the universe, I'm never going to do that. I'm looking at four people who are walking in the back of the room thinking, where have they landed? No, they've gone now. I walked in and went, this is not the birthday party. So I've lost my train of thought now. So in my intimate relationships is where things show up for me. And I think it can be very painful when you're in recovery. And my experience of it is that that's what propels people into places like ACA and also therapy. Now, I want to talk about my view about this is that there's two recoveries to be had for me. So I'm a product of a dysfunctional, abusive and neglected home. Before ACA, I'm going to end up in therapy if I'm lucky, to try and make sense of that, to try and unpack what was mine and what was yours. Most children who, in my experience, I should speak about myself, when I grew up in that home, what I don't learn is boundaries. I don't know where I begin and end and you begin and end, right? So my relationships, all of them are like this. Or they're like this. But they're never like this. And if I lean into you in a relationship, and I'm talking anything, friendship, intimate relationship, whatever, if I lean into you and you don't move, I'm out of there. So I will struggle with all of this stuff. And one of the things I learned about myself doing the fourth and fifth step, so I've come in, I understand that I'm powerless over people and authority field. Where am I? Here I am. I'm powerless over living with the effects of alcoholism. I'm powerless over so much more than that. It's unbelievable, but that'll do for today. I have to come to believe that a power greater than myself is going to restore me to sanity. What's sanity? I had no idea what that was. I said to a member once, how can I be restored to something I never was? I never felt like I was sane. And he said to me, how about physical, mental and spiritual wholeness? Would that do? And I said, yeah, that'll do. So that's my definition of insanity, sanity. And coming to the decision to practice self-love and trust in a higher power of our understanding. Now, that's really interesting because practicing self-love for me is really hard when I'm at step three. Man, I haven't begun the work. I'm not really getting to self-love until I'm down around about 8 or 9, but that's just not, that's me. Because I'm going to look like I love myself. But I don't have a conception of what parts of me that I love. Everything about myself that was hated by my parents, I hated. So let me do a segue, because there's been talk this morning about the different parts of ourselves. So I want to just do a little segue for a minute. Sigmund Freud was a master of all psychoanalytical thought. He was the psychiatrist who started to work with people with their dreams and their fantasies. This was never done. This is an era in the world where psychiatrists looked after really unwell, mentally unwell people. Doctors looked after the physical, and heaven forbid, the church did everything in between. So if you wanted to go and talk to someone, you went to a priest, or you shut up. He met Carl Jung at a conference who had also started to do this work in a similar way, dreams, fantasies, sort of more existential stuff. And there was a meeting in the minds. Carl Jung was 20 years his junior. So they started to work together with clients. Now, Freud's premise about neuroses was that all neuroses, which is what we suffer from, just by the way, relate to fear of sex and fear of death, which if you unpack it further, given sex is about procreation of the species, it's fear of living and fear of dying. So if you've got neuroses, baby, you're screwed either way. They had a falling out after a time. Carl Jung said this. He said, I think there's more than fear of sex and fear of death. I think there's a collective unconscious in the world, an energy. I think we each have a soul. And when we're in touch with all parts of our soul, we connect to the collective consciousness. Now, you can say that's higher power if you want. You can say it's energy. I don't mind what you call it. But it's alive and well in my life, I can assure you. Now, they had a shocking falling out. They did not speak again until just before Freud was going to die, and Jung went to see him and say goodbye. To discuss this with the profession of the day, because Jung was also a psychiatrist, he said to the profession, the soul is like a boarding house. And in a boarding house, there's all these different rooms. There's an attic, there's a cellar, there's stairways with little rooms underneath. And you hold the keys to your boarding house. And I hold mine. And I don't get into any of yours unless you unlock the doors. And you don't get into mine unless I unlock the doors. Now, I'm going to make a leap here and say to you that that traumatised child that I was, I put her in the cellar. Now, I didn't do that because I wanted her to be separated from me at that time, psychically. I did it because I couldn't look after myself at 7. And so I put her there to try and protect her. But then a strange thing happened. As I then went through my own life, addiction, and all of the events that happened through my addiction in my early years of recovery up until when I finally started to look at it through a 12-step program here and do therapy about it, I continued to leave her there. And every time I did not connect with her, I abandoned, I self-abandoned. And we've talked about abandonment today. Abandonment's bad. My view, neglect's worse. That's just my experience. I'm the neglected child. So I don't actually have any relationship with the most precious part of me, which is what we call in South Pacific the wounded child. You may call it in ACA the inner child. Mine was wounded. I needed to do 2 things to get her out of the cellar. I needed to come to ACA. I needed to get clean and sober first. That was the first thing, because that was what was going to kill me. Then I needed to come to ACA and I needed to do a 12-step program with a sponsor that had done it before me. I needed to find somebody in the world that I trusted when I trusted no one, not even myself. I mean, how can I trust myself if the best part of myself's in the cellar? Like, I've got no chance. I have to watch what you do. I have to listen to what you say in terms of your recovery. I have to trust that when you talk to me about what's happened to you in recovery, that it's true and that it's possible for me. So I come here and I start to try and connect with a power greater than myself. I start to do inventory. I tell someone the truth about what's happened to me. I reckon there's two recoveries to be had if you're someone like me, and maybe not everybody in the room is. If I've got trauma in my history, I need to do that therapeutically. If I also have addiction, which involves ACA and maybe a therapist that's trauma-informed, and I need to stay clean out of the substances or my process addictions, whatever they may be, work, sex, gambling, drugs, alcohol, food. It's a fairly high probability once you start doing this stuff, you'll think that you're doing well. I did. I thought I was doing very well. I was being of service, I was sponsoring people, I was going to meetings, I was speaking when asked, I was doing all that stuff. But there'll be often something that, you know, do you remember when we were kids at the beach and someone would flick you with a towel, you know, and you go like that? They flick you and you go like that. And that's what life does to you. You get a flick and you go, what's that? Oh, it's nothing to worry about. Pay attention. Pay attention to the flicks. Pay attention to the things that just don't seem quite right. Take it to your sponsor. Run through the steps. I couldn't tell you how many times I've done the steps in AA and in Al-Anon. I've done one lot through ACA. I'll be honest about that, only once. So, where does that leave me today? I was listening as people were sharing their experience, strength and hope this morning, and I felt very grateful. I'll tell you why. I felt very grateful, A, that I came here, but more importantly, that I stayed. And every time I stand at the abyss of my life and dive over one more time, usually with the help of a therapist, sometimes a sponsor, I will find that even though I'm still terrified about that, I've done it enough times now to understand that I come through the other side of it. There's been a lot of talk about inner critic that we have, and I'm of the belief that it lives in our head. And somebody shared beautifully this morning, I'm sorry, I don't know who's on it, it's a crosstalk, I don't mean to do that, it's just things that are coming to me. The feelings in my body are where the healing is. It's only to the extent that I'm prepared to go through feeling the difficulties that I come out the other side. When I work with clients, I often say to them, do you know there's only 8 emotions? And they go, no. I go, no, that's true. There's only 8 of them. I've got them on the wall in the practice. See, that's only 8 of them. We call them different things, you know. But every emotion that we experience, joy, love, guilt, shame, fear, loneliness, pain. I've forgotten one. Anger. Thank you. Has a gift. Has a gift. If we feel the emotions that we feel, in the moment we feel them, we will get the gift of the emotion. Let me see if I can remember. Love is connectedness. Anger is strength. Fear is wisdom. Come on, Pete, you can help me here. You should know these. Loneliness is reaching out. I've gotten the others. Sorry. In the moment. But there's also a toxic level of each moment. So, for example, anger's the classic. Toxic level is rage. Fear, terror, panic. Loneliness, despair and isolation. Show me an ACA and I'll show you despair and isolation. And when I've worked with clients in the past, I've often said, yeah, but look at when you look at that, you know, you look at the list of the emotions and the gift, but look at all of them are negative. Like there's only two good ones, joy and love. And I go, no, look at the gifts. The gifts are what we want, right? If I'm sitting in any toxic level of any emotion, I'm carrying stuff that's not mine. Now, when I'm a child and I'm having to pack up the house and put my dog that I know is going to be put to sleep in the back of the pound's van, what do you think happened to me? I stopped feeling and I got really, really fucking angry. Really angry. Because nobody was showing up in my life. And in those moments when I would go to the door and my mother would not answer me or my father was absent, what do you think I did as a child? I made their behaviour about me. My father is beating me because I have made him so angry. It's my fault. My mother will not stop drinking and come out and talk to me because I'm not good enough. I'm unlovable. So I get core beliefs about what I believe about myself and I get them from when I'm this high. And in the world of therapy, we call that carried emotions, carried shame, carried pain, carried fear, carried loneliness. And when we come to places like this, when I walked into the rooms of Al-Anon and ACA, I was carrying still, even after years and years and decades of recovery, the shame from my childhood. Why do you think I didn't want to have children? Because I knew that I would do to my child what my mother did to me in some way if I didn't sort it out. And nobody was talking about it then. We talk about it now. You talk about it all the time now. In the world, the circles I live in, it's very, very, you know, we're very free to talk about it. So when we're talking about carried emotional pain, we're talking about stuff that is not ours. And it's necessary, in my view, and my experience is, and it may not be anybody else's, I've had to go and do a lot of process work with that. I was blessed that I was sent over to the Meadows at in 2019 by the hospital to do some work on trauma and survivors. And I know there's people in the room that have done that also. And they had a program called Love Addiction and Love Avoidant. And all of that was about if I'm a heterosexual woman, the way I'm going to show up in my interrelationships is the relationship I have with my father. If I'm a homosexual woman, it's going to be the relationship I have with my mother. This is shocking for people to find out when they're in their years in recovery. It's like, you mean to tell me at 30 years of recovery, I've got to go back and unpack it again? Yes, that's what you've got to do. So when you get to that point in your recovery, and it will come if you stay, you'll be in the middle of something. Something will have happened. You'll have your hands, figuratively speaking, in your head, your head in your hands, and you'll be saying, I've done this work. I've done this. I've been through the steps. I've unpacked this with a therapist. And the universe will be asking you to do it one more time. Because there are layers and layers and layers of trauma in my experience. And the magnificent thing about this program and this fellowship is that you get to do it with each other. You don't do it alone. But it requires of me to reach out to somebody and say, I need a hand with this. 5 minutes, thank you. I'm just about ready to rock and roll and finish. So I just want to say, to have people in my life that I trust, to have people in my life that I love, to have people in my life that I've had the privilege to work with, them with me with them, has been one of the most liberating experiences I've had. How do I travel in my life today? I travel well. I don't feel like I'm shackled by my past. It's there. I look at it now and think to myself, all of those events, many of which were done to me and many of which I did to others, created me to be the person I am today. Has it been painful? Hell yes. there are moments in my life, and some of you will find this shocking, there are moments in my life where I think to myself, if I had to go through every day from the beginning to now to get to where I am, I'd say yes to it. Now, that's shocking, isn't it? Because I'm guessing there's plenty of people in the room today that are struggling with stuff, that don't want to be where they are, that don't want to be feeling how they are. But what I'm here to say to you is, you can integrate, walk through, share with others any experience that you've had in your life and get well. And there's only a few places in my experience on the planet that will offer you this. And this fellowship is one of them. I want to thank you for the opportunity of sharing. I hope it's been a little bit helpful. I'd be very happy to take questions or hear experiences, and I'm going to hand it back over to Brooke. Thank you, Brooke.